it was so clear that this was understudied, underserved, had not really been looked at very much from an engineering context, that there was so much potential there because the needs were so great and the knowledge was so poor. And so it just, I basically, everything that I did from that point on was to push myself towards spending more and more of my time doing reproductive research. And now that's what I do 100% of the time.
Welcome to AI for Pharma Growth, the podcast from pioneering pharma artificial intelligence entrepreneur, Dr. Andre Bates. This show aims to demystify AI for all those in biopharma, from startup biotech right through to big pharma. Each episode focuses on all things AI and future tech related to help pharma execs to navigate through the and benefit from the sometimes confusing but magical world of AI-powered tools to grow and get real-world results.
Today's episode is how AI is preventing maternal and fetal death, as well as complications during pregnancy. Maternal health, which encompasses the period from pregnancy to 1 year postpartum, is a pivotal component in women's overall well-being and health. Annually, there are around 300,000 maternal deaths globally, with a concerning rise in the US despite the declining global trend. The US exhibits stark racial disparities, with Black and Native American women experiencing maternal death rates three times higher than that of white women. And on a global scale, the significant prevalence of preterm births, accounting for 10% of all pregnancies and stillbirths, is still affecting almost 2 million babies annually worldwide. Today, I'm with Dr. Michelle Oyen, who is Associate Professor of Biomedical Engineering at Washington University at St. Louis, who is leveraging AI to improve the outcomes for maternal and fetal health. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Michelle. Can we start with you telling me a little bit about your background and how you got into this and how you got started?
Yeah, so I have a background in engineering, and I started doing my research as a graduate student in orthopedic biomechanics and studying bone and cartilage, things that are pretty well studied from an engineering perspective. Those are tissues in the body that have clear structural functions. And while I was doing that work, I was actually in the laboratory doing some experiments on cartilage, and I answered the phone from a cold call from an obstetrician. And yeah, he literally just asked when I answered the phone, "Is there anyone there who knows how to measure forces?" And I said, "Well, yes, I do. What on earth are you asking that question for?" And he said, "Well, I'm an obstetrician and I'm really interested in preterm birth. And I'm interested in particular in the premature rupture of the fetal membranes, which is something that happens in a large fraction of preterm birth, somewhere around 30 to 40%, and thus accounting for about 3 to 4% of all pregnancies. And this is something that clearly is a mechanical event because the membrane physically ruptures, and that is the end. There's no way to fix it. There's no way to intervene. And so we need to understand why and how this is happening." And so we started a collaboration as a little side project. And that actually led to, by the end of the time I was a PhD student, I was doing my PhD on the side, but employed in the obstetrics and gynecology department doing clinical studies on rupture of the fetal membranes with this doctor.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. It's so interesting how just some random phone calls changed the whole trajectory of your career.
Yes. Yeah, so I could have stayed in orthopedic biomechanics and done a pretty traditional career, but that just really, it was so clear that this was understudied, underserved, had not really been looked at very much from an engineering context, that there was so much potential there because the needs were so great and the knowledge was so poor. And so it just, I basically, everything that I did from that point on was to push myself towards spending more and more of my time doing reproductive research. And now that's what I do 100% of the time.
I love what you do. So when I first met you, I heard you speak at the Royal Society of Medicine. And it's such, the work you're doing is really impressive. But until what you have done, it seems to be, from the outside at least, a very underserved space. And largely because the human maternal fetal interface is quite different from the other animal models, and also because no one likes to experiment on pregnant women, the dangers to the fetus. So the work you're doing is quite unique in the way that you're doing it and actually changing the landscape of this whole space. So could you tell me a little bit about what you're doing and maybe some of the developments that have led to where you are now?
Absolutely. So we're very interested in all aspects of preterm birth. It's a syndrome, and so it can happen for different reasons. There can be maternal factors, placental factors, fetal factors, things to do with birth itself, and all of those are different. And so trying to untangle all of those different factors and try to understand why preterm birth is so prevalent, that's kind of the underlying motivation of my work. But because of that, we've also gotten involved with looking at stillbirth, with looking at maternal mortality, because these things are all intertwined.
Yeah.
Just very poorly studied. So there is a very well-developed component of reproductive biology. And in fact, I was at the Society for Reproductive Investigation International meeting last week, which is primarily reproductive biology. And that's the primary research going on here. But I come from an engineering background, and when I look at pregnancy and birth, I see mechanical factors everywhere. I see engineering factors. And I think that's where there's a real lack of background of people coming from engineering studying these problems. And I really just think that historically, that's partly because most engineers were men. And I attract almost exclusively female graduate students and postdoctoral fellows now. It's clear to young women how important it is to study these problems to do with reproduction and pregnancy from an engineering perspective, but historically this just was not a field that existed, and it's really exciting that it's growing now.
Yeah, it's true. I have a friend who's an engineer, and I remember when she went through university, she was the only woman in her entire class.
Yes, I did not have a single female engineering professor through bachelor's, master's, PhD. And I was also in classes where I was that one female student with 20 male students. And so it's changing really fast now. And that's really something that's exciting. Biomedical engineering is about 50-50 female and male students. And so that is changing, but it's slow to change at the top. All of the key pipeline discussions where we still don't have equality of numbers up in like full professor range or you know, deans and administrators. So, I mean, there's still work that needs to be done, but it is growing really fast.
That's really good. And that is part of why women's health is being looked at a bit more now, which is really good. Can you tell me what your research is all about and what you're doing?
Absolutely. So I have a number of different projects. They always have to do with pregnancy in some aspect. We have, I guess you could group them into a couple main categories. So one is that we make computational models of pregnant women. And so this idea of digital twins or trying to make virtual experiments, this is something that's very important and is central to all of our work. However, in order to make models of things, you sometimes have to study those things very carefully in the first place. And so we also do a lot with measuring the physical properties of reproductive tissues. And it probably won't surprise you to hear that there weren't published literatures with great quantitative estimates of the properties of the uterus or the fallopian tubes or the ovaries, the fetal membranes, the placenta, all of these tissues. And so in order to build the models, we have to get the data that we need to put into the models. So we can get geometry from medical imaging. And that's something that I actually did my PhD in medical physics after doing 2 degrees in engineering. And so we take data from things like ultrasound and MRI, and we use those to build the geometry of a pregnant woman. And of course, that's changing very quickly. And so you have to build independent models at different gestational ages. And then you also have to account for facts like the placenta can be anywhere in the uterus. So you have to also build separate models in which you account for that. But then we need those properties. And we need those properties as a function of gestational age, because things like the cervix softens close to birth. And so you've got changes in the mechanical properties and the physical properties as a function of gestational age as well. So we're in a large data gathering exercise in order to support our computational modeling. We have to build up all of this kind of reference database of the geometries and the physical properties that go into these computational models. And so some of our models are pretty holistic, like of an entire pregnant pelvis. Some are very detailed, like we're doing microstructural modeling of the placenta in order to study transport. Fetal growth restriction is something where you can have poorly functioning placenta leading to very small fetuses, and that's a high risk for stillbirth because the placenta is basically insufficient to get the fetus the oxygen and nutrients that it needs. And so we're building models of that to try to help with better prediction of when stillbirth is a great risk. And that's a really large project that we're working on right now as part of Welcome Leap, which is a UK-based move fast and break things kind of research opportunity. And so there's about 16 of us partners all over the world working on this stillbirth project that really focuses on the placenta.
That's amazing. And do you need to get data from all different kinds of women, or is there a lot of individual variation?
Yeah, there is a lot of individual variation, and that is exactly the kind of thing that we're doing. So reproductive tissues are actually, I wouldn't say readily available, but there's more of them available to test from humans than you might expect, because about 50% of women, at least in the United States, have a hysterectomy by the age of 65. So okay. In fact, the two most common surgeries in women are one, a C-section, and two, the removal of the uterus. And it's quite interesting because that hysterectomy is usually not associated with cancer. It's usually associated with non-cancerous reasons. And so we can get our hands on tissues from women of different ages who have had hysterectomies. There are racial variations. There are variations to do with how many times a person has been pregnant. And so again, it's, you know, this is where I think AI is going to be extremely important, because as we start gathering more and more of this data, we need to be able to cluster the data according to all of these different factors and figure out which ones of those are important that we need to build into our models explicitly.
Yeah, exactly. So how are you employing AI at the moment?
So we're doing a lot of machine learning with our placenta project. So in fact, we do a clinical study where we take ultrasound of the pregnant woman at different time points in the pregnancy, and then we actually collect the placenta after the baby's born. And then we do high resolution imaging of the placenta itself and build our sort of digital twins of the placenta from that data ex vivo. And then now we have this kind of whole range of images of the placenta at different points, you know, in ultrasound, in a live woman with a live fetus during the pregnancy, but then we also have this ex vivo tissue. And so we're using different imaging modalities and collecting for each individual patient. We're collecting a huge number of ultrasounds, but then we're also collecting high thousands to over 10,000 individual images of the placenta in order to build up these 3D geometries. And so in order to process all of that data, we're using machine learning to segment the tissue and to build these three-dimensional reconstructions for our functional models of diffusion and transport.
That's amazing. And so you're getting a lot of data from a lot of different women, and then you're able to personalize it by woman as well. That's really impressive.
And that's actually something that we're really keen on continuing going forward, because ultrasound is done routinely in pregnant women often throughout the pregnancy. And so one of the other projects that we have that we're really keen on from a personalized medicine perspective is the risk of a cesarean section scar rupture in a subsequent pregnancy. So right now, if you have a C-section, doctors will often say you have to have another C-section because you have this scar. And so we're saying, well, if we take ultrasound and we measure the geometry of that scar and we feed that into a digital twin model of the pregnancy, maybe we can predict when that scar is at a greater or lesser risk. And that would then allow us to sort of give patients the opportunity to have more choice about how they deliver their babies in subsequent pregnancy.
That's really cool. And so there's been a lot of advances in digital twins and synthetic data. I've seen a lot of the organ data for, you know, hearts and pancreas, et cetera, and tissues. So how are you leveraging some of these advances in what you're doing with the digital twins?
Well, I think just the infiltration of this phrase digital twins into the popular consciousness is very important, right? Because that gives people the idea that this is a thing. And as you said, cardiovascular models are very well advanced. Cancer models are very well advanced. Neuroscience and brain models are very well advanced. Pregnancy models practically haven't existed until now. And I think, again, that's partly because of who's making the models. And it's partly because of where the funding has been for scientific research. And that's been primarily and provably on diseases that affect men more than those that affect women. And so, you know, this has just been something, you know, there was some seminal papers that were published just in the last few years showing how this discrepancy in funding has affected diseases that primarily or disproportionately affect women versus men. And so the public consciousness is just getting there with this. And so I think, you know, since the potential here is actually greater in pregnancy because of the fact that you can't do experiments, because of the fact that you don't have good animal models, I think the importance for the future of digital twins here is arguably even greater. And so I say that out loud to anyone who will listen, because I think we just have to get this idea into people's heads that this is a real opportunity here. And I just like to flag the fact that this is slowly coming to the forefront, that late in 2022, there was a big change to the Food and Drug Administration regulation here in the US, allowing for computational models and ex vivo experiments, like organ on a chip kind of things, to be used for drug development and drug discovery. And so I think the idea that we can do more and more of this in computational, in silico, or in vitro, that will help us with the fact that these problems in pregnancy have been so underserved based on the fact that you can't do the experiments in pregnant women, there are no good animal models, et cetera.
Yeah, that's going to make a huge difference. I really hope that the EMA and the MHW in Japan follow suit and allow that. But I guess once the FDA has done it, it means that the others are more likely to. Which is
well, good. And I think we're waiting for the first examples where it was done using these different approaches to be successful, and then everybody will follow, right? So, I mean, right now, that's really where we're at, is since that regulation change was so recent, that was December of 2022, we're not at the point yet where there are a whole bunch of new approvals that came by that route. And so it's going to be really interesting to watch in the next few years.
Yeah, although I did about a few months ago, I did look up because I mentioned that you'd mentioned that to someone. And I did look up and I did find a drug that has been going through that has got digital twin data that the FDA have approved. So the drug's not fully approved yet, but it's on its way. So so it's nice to see that.
Absolutely.
Have you done any clinical studies?
So we do clinical studies. The placenta study that I was just telling you about is a clinical study. It's not a clinical trial. We're not changing anything with patient treatment. We're just gathering information. Okay. So that's the thing I haven't done yet. So all of the work that I've done has been clinical studies, gathering information, not clinical trials. And it is kind of an advantage that these tissues, the fetal membranes and the placenta, are discarded tissues, because after the fetus is delivered as a baby, those tissues, which were of fetal origin, are usually just thrown into biohazard bags. We're able to collect these tissues and study them and then correlate them back, like I said, to things in the pregnancy by looking at the ultrasound data or the clinical chart data from the mother. And so that's where we've been doing these sorts of clinical studies. But my hope is that as we get more information and we can start identifying mechanisms associated with some of these things, then we'll be able to move into the clinical trial space and start to do more interventionally in the future. Carefully.
Yes, of course. And so what kind of benefits do real women, like mothers and babies, can they expect to gain once you complete this batch of research?
Well, anything that we can do to reduce preterm birth is substantial. Mm-hmm. And I haven't mentioned yet preeclampsia, but that's another condition that we study that's unique in that it has lifelong effects on both the mother and the fetus. And so if a woman has had preeclampsia and has had hypertension during pregnancy and associated problems, that woman is at greater risk of cardiovascular disease following the pregnancy, you know, 10 years later, but then the fetus is actually at risk 40 years later of having more cardiovascular disease in the adult who was the product of that pregnancy. So this is a multi-generational problem with preeclampsia. Yeah. It's not just a condition that happens in pregnancy that we can just forget about after the pregnancy's over. And so if we think about how many people suffer from cardiovascular disease and how unbelievably common hypertension is in pregnancy and what a big factor that is in chosen delivery early, because that's a case where they often will go in and do a C-section prior to term, because removing the fetus and the placenta from the mother will actually often reduce the problems with hypertension and reduce the risk to the mother. So this is a huge population of people who have essentially lifelong cardiovascular disease profiles that are elevated because of something that happened in pregnancy. And it's not clear to me that the general population actually knows this.
Well, I didn't even know that. That's amazing that something that happens in pregnancy affects the child 40 years later.
Yep.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So that actually can have a huge benefit in terms of reducing cardiovascular conditions in people.
And that's, so preterm birth, you know, when you look at preterm birth, say, for example, you see a preterm birth at the 27, 28 week mark of pregnancy. So right at the border between the second trimester and the third trimester, a lot of those babies will survive, but a lot of them will have lifelong health complications associated with being so severely premature. And so again, given that 10% of babies are born premature and these morbidities associated with being born premature can affect the eyes, they can affect the lungs, they can affect, you know, all of these different body systems. So again, what proportion of the health of people who are living today might have something to do with these huge numbers of people who are born premature? One out of every 10. And that's worldwide. That's not a number that changes in developed countries versus developing. It's about 10% everywhere. And so that's a pretty substantial fraction of the global public.
That's enormous. And so have you got any examples where your work's actually already impacted someone, a mother or a baby?
I don't think that we're there yet. I think one of the things that we would say is that so little is mechanistically known. And I think, you know, there has been a big growth in interest in women's health in the last couple of years, but a lot of it has been in, I would call, symptom management, not in underlying mechanistic understanding. And so I think if you're thinking about the medical paradigm of better diagnosis, better prevention, better treatment, you have to have some mechanistic understanding. And so that means that the lack of basic science research and understanding behind pregnancy is a real trip to developing new devices, new drugs, everything else. And so in order to get to the point where we're successful with developing interventions, we need to understand what's actually happening better. And it's one of the things that surprised me the most when I first started researching in this field, when I would ask, you know, the physician that I was working with, you know, why do the membranes rupture early? You know, why did the membranes rupture prior to labor sometimes, and other times labor starts and the doctors actually have to go in and manually rupture the membranes because they didn't rupture on their own. And it turned out that they had no idea. So this is a doctor who's delivering babies, but they don't know what starts the process and why it's early sometimes. And so little is known. And I felt like it was just like we managed the process. And so people just assume that it always kind of works out. Although if you talk to people who have suffered from recurrent pregnancy losses or stillbirth or, you know, severe preeclampsia, they will tell you, no, we don't understand any of this. And this is a real problem.
That's amazing. And when you, as you said, you know, the numbers are so huge globally. It's incredible that until you really start talking to that doctor by that random phone call that no one was really looking at this. It's crazy, isn't it?
And I'm just, I'm totally happy about the fact that this is growing now. So I see this as there's a certain amount of research that I personally can do, and that's great. Yeah. But I'm also, you know, 20 years into my professional career as an academic, part of what my legacy is going to be is all of the students of mine who go on to work on this area themselves, because I think that's where we're going to see change. And the next generation is so enthusiastic about this topic. You know, I'm teaching a women's engineering class for the first time this semester. I have almost 50 students. and the vast majority of them are female. And so this is a group of people who want to work in this field. And this is one class, one semester, one year.
One university,
One university, exactly.
That's really nice to hear. Yeah, it's amazing how these disparities are just so large. Every Women's Day, I kind of look at the numbers and it kind of often isn't very encouraging in lots of areas. So at least in your space, it's improving, which is nice to see.
Yes.
What's next for your research? Where are you planning to go with this?
Well, we're really working hard on these computational models for digital twins. And I think that's our real priority right now is, as I said, kind of this two-pronged approach of one, collecting all of the data, so the imaging data, tissue property data, and two, then just building these different models at different gestational ages so as to be able to use them. And then in parallel with that, we do a little bit of organ on a chip kind of in vitro work. And again, it's for, you know, being able to test our virtual placentas and having, you know, with an organ on a chip system, we can try to do some validation. I think one of the biggest questions always with digital twins is how do you validate the models? Mm-hmm. And that's a challenge across all digital twins, not just those to do with pregnancy or even just those to do with health. It's, you know, validating the models and ensuring that you're getting good results that are quantitative and sensible is an issue with all computational work. And so that's where I think the next steps for us are, because in order for people to have confidence in these models, we have to have validation.
Of course,
and that validation is affected by the fact that we cannot do these experiments in live pregnant women.
How far away are we, do you think, from a point where a woman who's pregnant can actually get her own digital twin model of what's going on and predict how these things could happen and how to prevent them?
I think I'm very optimistic that 10 years from now, pregnancy will look nothing like it is now.
Wow. That's nice to hear it so soon, because there are so many things 20 years ago I thought we would have had by now, but we haven't.
Well, I may be overly optimistic. So, I mean, I'm always going to be accused of being overly optimistic, perhaps, but I do think, you know, a very large part of my job right now feels like it's shining light on these issues. You know, it just seems like people are surprised when they realize that this is so understudied and that you know, humans reproduce all the time and that we know so little about it. So if we can just draw more attention to it, and, you know, that helps to grow the field, that helps to make people aware of it. And then that drives things like funding and startup companies. Yeah. We haven't talked about the femtech industry yet, but that's something I'm really excited about, which is this growth of companies that are devoted to women's health, including pregnancy health. And there are a lot of startups in this space right now. And the big report that was just released by McKinsey in, I think, January or February was saying this is a $1 trillion industry for women's health, because they recognized how underserved it is. And so they were saying, you know, the growth in this industry is $1 trillion. And that's, you know, that's the kind of number that gets people's attention.
Yeah, finally. Yes. Yeah. It's amazing. Wow. Well, I loved hearing all about what you're doing. And for anyone listening who wants to get in touch with Michelle and her team at Washington University in St. Louis, there's two websites. One is going to take me a bit longer to do, but it's the university one, which is engineering.wust.edu/faculty/Michelle-Oyen.html. Or the easier one is winlab.org. So you can get in touch with her at either of those places. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. And hopefully in 10 years, you're right, that we can all have that. That would be amazing.
That's the plan.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of AI for Pharma Growth. If you have received huge value from this show, or maybe this episode has highlighted how you can use AI in your company, then we would love for you to support the show by leaving us a 5-star rating. Please make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button on your podcast app now, to make sure you never miss an episode.